This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Well, finally, warm temperatures and sunny skies, now that we're halfway through April. Well, take a break from the gardening and settle in. We've got a lot of news from the WMRA team and from around Virginia in the next half hour. Our own Jordy Yeager filed a follow-up to our Refugees in Virginia series with a look at one Burmese family literally making a new home for themselves in Charlottesville with some help from Habitat for Humanity. And we've also got a report on why next Saturday is going to be Mediation Pioneer Larry Hoover's Day in Harrisonburg. There was also a flurry of activity from Richmond last week as Governor McAuliffe shuffles through the General Assembly's work. We'll have reports from Virginia Public Radio on plans to have lethal drugs available to avoid further use of Virginia's electric chair. Ongoing wrangling over ethics rules in the wake of the Bob McDonnell case, sexual assault on college campuses, a look at Virginia's income tax system, and also a report on the boom in drugstore jobs in the state. But first, is climate change affecting Virginia's vineyards? Or is it just crazy spring weather? A balmy February and March encouraged plants to bud early, only to be damaged or killed by the bitterly cold temperatures over the last week. WMRA's Jesse Nadler talks to two winemakers in Rockbridge County about techniques and strategies they employ to keep up with shifting weather patterns. For the hundreds of refugees who resettle in Virginia, home is a place they've left behind. For an update on our series on refugees, WMRA's Jordy Yeager has this story about what it takes to build a new home here in America.
Remember how warm it was in March? A week of highs in the mid to upper 70s. Forsythia bloomed, green grass shot up, only to be followed by this freakishly cold April. Temperatures dipped to the low 20 degrees last Saturday night, with temperatures 15 or 20 degrees below average last week. The early spring, followed by this harsh blast of winter, has been a big concern for area winemakers. The state wine industry, some 255 wineries in all, has an annual economic impact of $750 million, according to the Virginia Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Mary Hughes and David Vermillion own and operate Jump Mountain Vineyard, a small 3-acre vineyard of 4,000 vines in Rockbridge County. It's a beautiful site, gorgeous views of the mountain, great elevation, great soil, but the topsy-turvy weather patterns have hurt their small production. Mary Hughes shows me a plant damaged by the most recent weekend freeze.
You know, if they have started to leaf out, like this vine that we're showing you here mm-hmm. has already started to do, then it's at a very fragile, or if it's all the way out with leaves, then obviously at 32, when it freezes, the open buds can be damaged. The leaves can be, you know, burned by frost. If you cut this open, you'll see that the bud is dead. It's brown inside.
When the couple planted their first vines in 2008, the plan was to grow vinifera, or non-hybrid grape varieties, such as Refosco, which is a temperamental Italian grape, and Cabernet Sauvignon. Vinifera produce great-tasting wines, but they're not the most cold-tolerant. In fact, the couple had 100 Refosco plants die 2 winters ago.
Oh, it's pretty heartbreaking. 2 years ago, after the polar vortex, we didn't see immediately the split vines. But then when they leafed out in the spring, we thought, oh, great, they're alive, they survived. But then they started flagging as the season got warmer and the rains stopped coming and the vines were under stress. They just couldn't sustain the leaf growth. And that's when we started seeing the vines die.
They've since replanted, but have to wait a few weeks until the new vines leaf out before they can assess the full damage from the recent freezes.
We're hoping that this is just an extraordinary event that isn't going to change our game plan about the type of grapes that we grow. But, I mean, I guess after year of this kind of problem, we might switch.
She's talking about switching, or rather adding, the popular French-American hybrid to their production. French American hybrids are hardier and can withstand greater weather fluctuations.
Oh, there's a lot of it grown in Virginia, that for sure. We were hard-headed and wanted to do, I guess, this difficult thing, which Virginia Tech, in all fairness, had warned us that the Shenandoah Valley might not be the best place to try to grow the vinifera grape varieties.
It is very true. Virginia has not got the ideal climate for growing grapes.
Shep Rouse is the owner and operator of Rockbridge Vineyard, 18 acres in Raphine, where he harvests some 80 tons of grapes per year, Pinot Noir, Riesling. The majority of his vineyard is the French-American hybrid.
So we have a continental climate, and continental climates are prone to spikes in the temperature this time of year. Warm weather in February, cold weather after warm weather. We also get hailstorms, hurricanes, tornadoes.
So how does he protect his plants? Well, his site, which he's owned since 1989, is on a slope and offers some protection from the cold.
And we get enough of a temperature inversion that the coldest air goes down into the valleys, and that displaces warmer air, which comes up.
He also double prunes, an increasingly common practice as a hedge against unpredictable spring weather. The Jump Mountain winemakers double prune as well. The downside? It's double the work.
Unless global warming actually changes the weather pattern here such that we don't get these late spring frosts, I think we just feel it's part of the price that we pay for growing these grapevines in Rockbridge County, which we think has a lot of advantages too. But the weather in the spring is our hard time of year.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
For the hundreds of refugees who resettle in Virginia, home is a place they've left behind. For an update on our series on refugees, WMRA's Jordy Yeager has this story about what it takes to build a new home here in America.
One step at a time, Win Thon climbs the stairs inside his new home. Wynn and his family don't live here yet, but every Saturday, he joins a Habitat for Humanity construction crew to work on what's soon to be their very first own home. Wynn is a 42-year-old refugee from Burma, and he's one of the 28 refugee families in the Charlottesville area that Habitat has helped permanently house over the last decade. Owning your own home is a crowning moment for anyone, but especially for refugees like Wynn, who have been fleeing persecution for years, sometimes decades. He's part of the Karen, an ethnic minority in Burma that's been fighting the government for independence since the 1940s. Before he came to Charlottesville in 2005, he lived in several refugee camps. He also tells me he was a lieutenant in the Karen military. About 15 years ago, he was out on foot patrol in Burma when he came across a series of three landmines in the road. One to his right, one to his left, and one that he didn't see behind him.
I don't see the bomb, three bombs. The left side here, right side here, my back here. I don't see the back. I see the two bombs.
So you step back?
Yeah, I take out the bomb and I step back. The one soldier, he see to me, brother, don't move, stay. Why? You lean the mine, you left. I told, no, mine, this two people. No, another one, he said to me. Okay, I said. I left my bomb.
Like many refugees I've met in Charlottesville, Wynn has a remarkably cheerful outlook on life, even in the face of extreme hardship, like losing the lower half of his right leg. After 5 years of using crutches to get around, he's now got a metal prosthetic limb. He works as a technician at the UVA hospital, and perhaps most importantly, he no longer lives in a plastic-roofed bamboo hut in a refugee camp. Instead, this July, he'll be moving his wife and their two boys into their new home, which they plan to own. It's a beautiful Saturday, and several dozen Habitat staff, volunteers, and partner families are on the construction site. In total, Habitat is helping construct 18 subsidized houses in this new neighborhood, while Southern Development Homes is building nearly 30 more to sell at market rate, which will result in something that Habitat heavily supports, mixed-income housing. Another of Habitat's trademarks is educating their home buyers about complex topics like mortgages, adjustable interest rates, and credit scores. They also ask families to pitch in with on-site construction help, or sweat equity, as they call it.
Every week on Saturday, I walk to the Habitat home, I get an hour, you know.
What's really important to understand is that Habitat is a partnership.
Dan Rosenzweig is the president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greater Charlottesville.
We don't build homes for people. We build homes with people. We work side by side with families who want a better future for themselves and for their children. They earn a zero interest loan for volunteering for sweat equity, indexed to what they can afford to pay. And we remain the note holder so that family comes to us 10 years from now and is having a hard time paying their mortgage because they have a family illness or something like that, we'll work with them to make sure that they succeed.
If you've already started going the same way, just keep going that way.
Today, Wynn is painting.
Wynn's super fast. Yeah. I can't even keep up with you, Wynn.
Wynn's not painting his soon-to-be house. He's painting a neighbor's soon-to-be house. And that's the other thing about Habitat. You get to know all of your neighbors months before you actually move in. That's huge for refugees, who often feel isolated in the U.S. In Wynn's neighborhood, 6 families have moved in so far, and today their kids race up and down the streets on their bikes. Wynn and his wife have 2 boys.
He does. He has 2. And Johnny, his youngest, just had his 5th birthday party actually last Saturday.
Amy Alamong is a volunteer engagement associate for Habitat.
Wynn bought everybody on-site pizza and brought his 2 sons, Johnny and Thang, and they came out and celebrated Johnny's birthday on the site in their house with the volunteers. That's awesome. Last Saturday. It was really cool.
On Wynn's lunch break, he takes me on a brief tour of his house.
Yeah, maybe pour the cock and penis. Yeah, the painting.
Painting, and then the
electrical work is done. The drywall is hung, and full buckets of joint compound huddle in the center of the first floor bedroom. Wynn says he's not sure which bedroom he'll end up taking. Each of his sons will have their own room on the 2nd floor, and he's considering taking one of the other 2 upstairs bedrooms to be close to them. But climbing the stairs is hard on his leg, and so the bedroom on the 1st floor is appealing too. For now, he's taking it 1 step at a time, and that means getting back to painting. After all, July is just around the corner.
Are you excited?
Yeah, excited.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
This year in Harrisonburg, April 23rd, next Saturday, we'll have a new name, Larry Hoover Day. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports.
Harrisonburg Mayor Chris Jones is issuing a proclamation honoring local attorney Larry Hoover with a day named in his honor. Hoover was one of the founders of the Community Mediation Center, now the Fairfield Center, and a pioneer of the alternative dispute resolution movement in Virginia.
I can't believe it. I'm flattered. I think it's time for there to be a recognition of the importance of dispute resolution in the community.
Attorney Catherine Fairfield was another of the Mediation Center co-founders.
He is really one of the best human beings that I have known. His life exemplifies the principles of this very human process of working together.
Fairfield says that Hoover's motivation was a matter of faith, but also practical.
Seeing people struggling through the legal system, he felt that this would be an alternative that would be a viable one on many fronts. On emotional fronts, on financial fronts, on the quality of the outcome.
That's what we ought to be doing, is talking it out. But of course, it's easier said than done, and it doesn't happen automatically.
Hoover will be commemorated with the first Lawrence H. Hoover Jr. Award for Excellence in Peaceable Service to the Community at the 33rd Anniversary Dinner of the Fairfield Center on his day, April 23rd, 2016. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
The nation's aging population is feeding the need for more pharmaceuticals, and that means more jobs in drugstores. Here in Virginia, one chain has found a novel way to staff 340 locations. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman has that story.
On any given day, CVS claims it has 300 jobs available at its stores in Virginia. To help assure a reliable labor pool, it turned to the state and proposed training disabled people at the Wilson Workforce and Rehabilitation Center in Fishersville. Vice President David Casey says the training program is a win for his company, the employees, and a government that will now collect taxes from people who might not otherwise be working.
It's a talent pool that's available for us, and we're going to take advantage of it.
It costs about $1,400 to train each person in the program, a bill that critics say should be paid by CVS. Governor McAuliffe and 3 Republican lawmakers were on hand to cheer the program. In the last election cycle, CVS gave $41,000 to Republican candidates in Virginia and another $6,500 to Democrats. But none of that matters to 22-year-old Kaylee Rushing, who has several learning disabilities. She's excited to have her first job with CVS.
I'll be like, hello, do you need assistance? And if they don't, then I'll be like, have a lovely day, and if you need anything, just come and tell me.
The rehab center is funded in large part through the U.S. Department of Education. I'm Sandy Hausman.
Governor Terry McAuliffe is rejecting a bid to bring back the electric chair as the default method of executing criminals on death row. Instead, he's proposing a plan that would allow the state to get lethal drugs from secret providers. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
Members of the General Assembly rejected a similar plan last year when several members argued that open government required public disclosure of where the drugs came from and who manufactured them. Now the governor says giving the supplier of lethal drugs anonymity is the only way to avoid forcing inmates into the electric chair, which he says is reprehensible.
If they do not accept my amendments, I want to be very clear, I will veto this bill. A veto of this bill will halt capital punishment in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Quentin Kidd at Christopher Newport University says lawmakers are in a tight spot.
The General Assembly is not going to override the governor's changes here. I think you're going to hear some voices who will be critical of him, but I think there won't be enough of those voices to override the governor's changes to this bill.
Members of the General Assembly will convene in Richmond next week to consider the governor's amendment.
Lawyers involved in the corruption conviction of former Governor Bob McDonnell have been busy with a flurry of legal briefs back and forth as the date for oral arguments approaches at the U.S. Supreme Court. Michael Pope has that story.
None of the facts in the briefs are new, and many of the arguments have been rehashed through the trial and the appeal. But now that the case is before justices, it's being presented in a different way. White-collar defense attorney Michael Levy says that's because the Supreme Court is a different audience, one that sees itself as responsible for reining in government excess.
The Supreme Court overturned broad interpretations of federal criminal statutes 9-0 in the Jeff Skilling case, in the Sun Diamond case, in the Arthur Anderson case.
Carl Tobias at the University of Richmond Law School says the briefs to Supreme Court justices are aimed at broadening the discussion beyond Virginia, arguing that letting the decision stand will hamper all politicians and normal political behavior.
It certainly turns up the pressure and tries to generalize beyond just a specific litigant. Whether the court will agree with that is not clear. We just have to see.
Oral arguments are set for April 27th.
And even as former Governor McDonnell awaits for the Supreme Court to hear his appeal in that bribery conviction, lawmakers in Richmond are trying to chip away at new ethics rules created in the wake of that scandal. But as Michael Pope tells us, current Governor Terry McAuliffe is proposing amendments.
Members of the state Senate initially wanted to allow lawmakers to accept unlimited steak dinners from lobbyists. They eventually struck a compromise with House members that allowed them to accept unlimited meals as long as each meal was worth less than $20 each. Now, Governor Terry McAuliffe is sending that idea back to the kitchen, telling lawmakers they must continue to count individual meals toward the $100 annual limit, although they can continue to accept unlimited gifts, like baseball hats, as long as they're worth less than $25 each.
Lawmakers are on solid ground when they argue that an individual vote is not going to be bought for a steak dinner.
That's Stephen Farnsworth at the University of Mary Washington.
But make no mistake about it. Offering goodies to lawmakers is good business. If it were not good business, lobbyists wouldn't be doing it.
Jeff Skelly at the University of Virginia Center for Politics says the bill isn't really a fix for a system that allows unlimited campaign contributions.
It's not really addressing the issue, which is the potential for corruption, the potential for quid pro quo.
Lawmakers need only a simple majority to overturn McAuliffe's amendment, although they risk having the bill vetoed and starting over again next year.
Well, I hate to remind you, but it's tax time. Have you filed yet? If you have, you're part of a system that funds most state government functions in Virginia. As Michael Pope tells us, Virginia relies more on income taxes for its state revenue than almost any other state.
Only Oregon has a higher percentage of state tax revenue that comes from income taxes, and that's because it doesn't have a sales tax. That puts Virginia in second place with about 58% of its state tax revenue coming directly from income taxes.
Virginia is among the more progressive states.
That's Frank Shafroth, director at the Center for State and Local Leadership at George Mason University.
States that depend much more on sales and use taxes tend to impose much greater taxes on low and moderate income persons than higher income persons.
Now, despite the reliance on income tax for most state revenues, Virginia has one of the lowest tax rates. Luke Jaday is an analyst at the University of Virginia Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service.
We have a relatively low expenditures per capita. Virginia's state government actually has a smaller budget than most states of its size.
So that's one reason. The other is wealth. Virginia ranks 7th in per capita income.
There's a lot of money in Virginia, and as a result, you can have a lower rate, but still end up with a lot of cash at the end.
Now, Virginia is one of only 6 states where more than half of state revenues come directly from income taxes. I'm Michael Pope.
Among a handful of bills the governor signed last week is a measure to help victims of sexual assault on college campuses. Campus staff members who investigate those assaults will now go through sensitivity training. Mallory No Pain reports.
The training will be required of anyone involved in the rape investigation on a college or university campus, people like school police, local law enforcement, or the university official whose job it is to work with victims.
In some cases, they know what to do, and they've been trained. In some cases, they haven't. And there really has not been any sort of uniform training with the goal of treating the victim with the sensitivity that they need.
Delegate Eileen Filocorn, a Democrat from Fairfax, was the bill's main sponsor. She stood alongside the governor at Virginia's Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance in Richmond as he spoke on the importance of giving victims support and justice.
They are entitled to our best efforts, and we are going to give them our best efforts.
The governor signed 4 new laws to aid in that cause, including one that ensures all rape kits will be tested for DNA evidence. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. Deep below the Pacific Ocean's surface lies a ferromanganese crust, a hard, metallic layer formed from iron-60. Iron-60 is a known radioactive isotope, an unstable version compared to the normal elements around us. This element has a half-life of 2.5 million years. When compared to the Earth's age of 4.6 billion years, this is very young. So in finding such material, we know that this iron-60 must have been deposited very recently. Where did it come from? What produced this iron in the first place? The most likely source for such a radioactive isotope is a massive star, some 8 to 10 times the mass of our sun, that exploded in a cataclysmic explosion about 2.5 million years ago. But wait, the story gets even more incredible. If astronomers are correct, then this supernova was very close. Around the same time as this material hit the Earth, the planet transitioned from the Pliocene to the Pleistocene. The Pleistocene epoch saw cooling of the atmosphere and repeated ice ages. Is there a connection between a nearby supernova, or maybe even a series of supernovae, and the cooling of our planet some 2 million years ago? More work is needed in solving this mystery whodunit. I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'm taking some time off for the next couple of weeks, so enjoy the rest of your Sunday. And happy Larry Hoover Day.